Before we start with anything new, is there anything left over from last week that we should talk about? Any thoughts or unfinished ideas? The last thing I laid on the board was the horizontal Y resting there. Subconscious, superconscious. No?
I think one thing that stuck with me was this idea of the self and what is delusion versus what is real in respect to the self.
That's a good question. Did somebody ask me a question? Did you ask me that question last week?
Mm-mm.
Somebody in some context asked me a giant question about mm-hmm. that. What is delusion? What is real? What is the self? That's, you know, it's, I know what it was, actually. I started thinking about it during this week that I needed to explain that.
Oh, okay.
So I think
I'll wait for today's
actually,
class.
No, I'll do it right now.
Okay.
But it occurred to me exactly that that very question needed to be answered. You'll have to forgive me sometimes if all the people I talk to sort of blend into one. I know you all individually, but I can't always remember who asks me what now. That's where I've begun to lose the thread. If I can see, if I can visualize it, then I can remember. So I'm trying to put all those pieces together. In spiritual matters, especially when you start talking in Buddhist terms, this doesn't come up so much in Christianity, but, you know, two of you were not even, you know, native to this culture, so these are obviously not foreign thoughts to you. There's this idea of the ego. And Buddhism talks about overcoming the ego. Hinduism, yoga talks about overcoming the ego. Christianity doesn't really have a construct for that. In fact, their vision of heaven is you just go to heaven pretty much as you are and get to live pretty much as you are, except all the icky people are in hell. Swamiji describes eternity pretty much as we are is about the closest thing to hell as that he can imagine. So it's hardly a heavenly realm if you really stop and think about it. But the way Yogananda parses this apart is, to my mind, the clearest and most interesting way to think about it. Just as we were talking last week about the subconscious, conscious, and the superconscious, those levels of reality are all different, but when you're on any one of those levels of reality, you can't just say, this isn't happening. Because when you're there, it's happening. It's happening as much as anything, and it's not even useful to say, this isn't really happening. The way Yogananda puts it perfectly, every level of reality is real on its own level. And it only ceases to be real when you transcend it and then can see it from a higher level. When you're sound asleep in a dream, it's happening. And it doesn't end. The suffering that you're going through or the elation that you're feeling is as real as anything else you experience until you awaken from it. And then when you awaken from it, you can, even though the experience of it affected you, you realize, oh, it was just a dream. That's what you say. And if you have an episode of psychosis or depression or something that torques your perception of reality, but then you come out of it, then you realize things were twisted. It wasn't what it seemed to me. So what the concept of superconsciousness and yoga and so on presents is the fact that that continual transcendence and then looking back goes on much higher, much farther, and into a greater reality that we can't imagine than where we stand right now. Even just, for example, even if in this lifetime you were addicted to alcohol, and the whole time you're addicted to alcohol, it seems like such a good idea, then you come out of that addiction, and you think, what could I have been thinking? You know, or you're in love with somebody who's very destructive to you, and you come out of that destructive relationship and you think, what could I have been thinking? And so the self-realized masters and the yoga masters tell us that many other things that are not universally described as madness or delusion or addiction or negative are just as destructive and just as delusory from the point of view of our true happiness as things that we can stand and look back and see are. And that becomes, at a certain point, an act of intuitive faith, I would call it. Because the evidence that we've experienced so far, plus the testimony of individuals whose veracity seems unassailable to us, causes us to begin to believe that I can keep going in this direction and the result is going to be consistent with my past, which is I'm just going to keep turning corners and seeing a greater and greater reality, and there's no end to it. To use the word real and unreal is a confusion that the English language thrusts upon us. And it also leads to a confusion about knowing how to properly relate. And it gets people into things like, well, I'm married, but, you know, all of this world is just a dream, so I don't really have to relate to it properly, you know. And my children are just a tremendous bother, but it's all just a dream, and I can just sort of let it go. It leads to a great sense of irresponsibility and a lack of common sense. And that's where Yogananda is saying that every level is real on its own level, and you can't disregard the rules of that level of reality until you've genuinely transcended them. But every higher level of reality has mastery over the levels below it. So the more advanced you become in your awareness, rather than making you incompetent on other levels of reality that are more confined than the one you're on, in Autobiography of a Yogi, Yogananda quotes his own guru. Yogananda's at the bottom, and Sri Yukteswar is the one on the side to the right. He says, as he puts it, saintliness is not dumbness. Spirituality is not incapacity. Because people like use it as an excuse. But he says just the opposite, and he actually trains Yogananda to be very attentive to the details of life. Did you lock the back gate? Did you put your valuables in the safe? But Yogananda himself says poor spiritual training had taught him to think that he could be careless about many ordinary things because, after all, he was living on a higher level. I mean, Yogananda sort of playing a game when he writes like that, but that's how he writes it for the lesson for us. Now, that's one answer. Does that...
That's very helpful.
Then there's another aspect to it, though, that I want to add to it, which is the whole question of ego. Okay? There is an infinite whole. I was holding the fingers of my hand, as I recall, in this class, trying to explain about how we have this apparent differences, but we come from the same source. But what happens to us is that we become identified, deeply identified, with the characteristics of our compressed reality. We are two things at the same time. We are infinite in our source and infinite in our roots, you might say. And then we are limited in our ability to express that infinity, to access that infinity, to really live from it. A self-realized master, Jesus, Yogananda, Buddha, Krishna, all of them express. They have a body, they have a mind, they have a personality, they have parents, and so on. But they are never limited by the limited conditions in their life. They always have full access to the infinite part. But yet, infinity becomes individual. And all of us live in some unique individual aspect. And there is no English word for that individuality. You have to use a Sanskrit word, and that word is jiva. You know, infinity expresses itself individually, and that consistent individuality is called the jiva. We might use the word soul in English, except soul is a confusing word because soul could also mean the infinite. So you don't really have the unique reality of the jiva described by the word soul, but that's the closest word to it. So once we get into the concept of reincarnation, where something goes from incarnation to incarnation, and that which was a man in one life becomes a woman in another, that which was born in India in one life is born in France in another, you know, that which is a brilliant musician in one life becomes an engineer in the next life. What is it
that's going through all of those lives. We can use the word soul and understand what we're saying, but the more accurate word is jiva. So sometimes I just have to use the word jiva because it just says it. So all of us have a jiva. We are a jiva. We are an individual soul. When we become free, we become called what's jivan mukta. Mukta means free. And if you're a jivan mukta, you're still living in an individual body, but the jiva has become free. You're jivan mukta. It's a state of high spiritual realization. Now, what happens is the jiva, the infinite potential within us, becomes identified. And identified is a fabulous word. It becomes identified with the limited conditions that it's experiencing now. So this jiva has had many, many incarnations, and in its essence is infinite. But the jiva, when it incarnates in a physical body, all of a sudden I am either a man or I am a woman. All of a sudden I am from one culture. If I'm from India, I'm not from France. If I'm speaking English, I'm not speaking Greek. If I am married, I'm not unmarried. If these are my children, then those are not my children.
So is it like particularized?
It becomes particularized, and then it becomes deeply identified with it. And that the deeper the identification, the more the link is severed with the infinite. And the less identified we are with it, the more other realities can also penetrate the experience of living in this particularized way. Because Yogananda, this is a photograph, because he died in 1952, he was this particular person. He was a Bengali man, born in 1893. He came to America, he taught Kriya Yoga, he had disciples, he ate mangoes, he was a good Indian cook, he had a beautiful singing voice. You know, he was a certain height, a certain weight. All of these things were true. They were all particular. He did not identify. He identified with the infinite and then knew that his individuality was going to express in this particular way, but because he never identified with it, he just was responsible for it. See the distinction? He was responsible for being Yogananda. He had to feed that body, he had to speak the language, he had to take care of the responsibilities, but he never defined himself. Go ahead. You're bringing in and bringing out.
Yeah, so when you talk about this, I mean, you said you were going to go deep with the metaphysics and kind of how, so with the art, with the life to life, the incarnation. Right.
Uh-huh.
I mean, is that limited to this planet? How do you perceive that, and do you include animals? And I mean, I know that's kind of maybe off the subject.
No, that's the question everybody asks.
Where are we? I mean, I'm watching things about, you know, the universe and how far we can see out and planets and, you know.
I'll answer you now from what Yogananda says, because how do I know? Do we always, he's asked directly, this is in the book Conversations with Yogananda, Kriyananda says, do we always incarnate on this planet? Oh no, Yogananda said, the universe is teeming with life. There are countless planets you can incarnate on. He says the idea that we're the only inhabited planet in the galaxy even, he said, is just ludicrous. He says there's life everywhere, and that UFOs are perfect fact. And he just makes this as an absolute statement. And he says there are just limitless possibilities. All the different scientific science fiction ideas that you hear about, many of them, he says, are simply true. So start there, okay? However, everything in creation has a certain unified reality. And that unified reality is, the spiritual eye. Right here, this is the picture. And this is about meditation, which I was going to start writing on tonight. When you meditate, this is a form that you will see. And this is not my saying, you might, Yogananda says, some people do, on this path you will. This is a form that you will see. And you can actually create it by rubbing your eyes a little bit like that, and you will see a bright ring, a dark field, and a bright point in the center. This is a five-pointed star. You are actually, in a metaphysical sense, you are looking at your own chakras and the own energy up your spine. You don't have to have any faith to see this. If you go into a certain higher state of consciousness, you will see this. The entire story of Jesus and the star over the
manger where Jesus was born is the star. In the Bible, they call it his star, because when you penetrate through the star, you go into a state of infinite consciousness. I'm just going to throw those things out without explaining them right at the moment, okay? But everything about us is based on the five-pointed star. 5 points. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. In the Christian teaching, they call it the dove. And then there's the points you can go. If you go into our church here, which was a Catholic church, they took the sacraments, which are the centerpieces of all those windows were the sacraments, but the outline of it is blue, gold, and white, and the top feature is a dove, which is just perfect for when it became our church, and they took everything else out, but they left that because it's the same image. You go to the Vatican, and you go into the center of this thing that's in the huge thing that's in the middle, and you stand in the middle of this huge thing that's in the middle, and you look up, it's that symbol, except the center is a dove. Whoever made it, meditated, saw it, and put it in this exquisite gold and blue and thing like that. So therefore, there is this unifying reality through all of creation, because all of the manifested world is an opportunity for the jiva to remember its infinity. And the drama through all these many different planets, many different levels of creation, is the jiva becoming identified with a limited material manifestation, and then through its many incarnations of experience, learning its own greater reality, realizing its true self. That's what I said at the beginning. You realize it, you don't create it, you simply become aware of what was always there, you transcend limited reality and embrace a higher reality. Animals are simply jivas, but just identified with a much more limited form. It has less capacity. The physical human body has a nervous system refined enough to experience infinity. The dog does not. The cat does not. The whale does not. The dolphin does not. They have notable aspects to their character that may seem more advanced than a human being, but it's actually because they are less evolved rather than more so, but they are less evolved in the sense that they are still more connected to everything, but they haven't yet been tempted by the freedom of being an individual, which then you have to transcend to realize the infinite again. Does that make sense? Swami Kriyananda said to me once that he sees all beings, from dogs, humans. He said it's just all egos on some scale of limitation or realization striving to be free. And that a dog is not fundamentally different than a human being. It's just less, the jiva is less conscious and therefore has manifested a body that is less capable of experiencing than a human being. We manifest bodies that are just simply the limit of what we're able to experience.
Right. So when I look at the cats running around the community and I say, man, they got it made, it's just me wanting to kind of regress a little bit
it's
and just have it easier.
Exactly right. But you see,
it's kind of like going to sleep a little bit.
That's, yes, going to sleep over again. So we do look toward them longingly. You can tell what the animals are like because of their tails. In the realm of the chakras, see, our energy, this is the spiritual eye, this is the image that we're going to come to here. And when we meditate, we meditate with our focus here. And the more advanced we are as human beings, the more we live in our upper chakras. The less advanced we are, the more we live in our lower chakras. You know, and you see people walking around and you can just tell all their energy is in their pelvis. That's where their life is. You know, they don't have a lot of energy in their heart, they have a lot of energy in their brain. Certainly don't have much ascending to the spirit. They're just all living from here. You know, or they live in their bellies. And that's why, you know, you sort of start looking for more refined art forms, more refined ways of dressing, more refined ways of expressing yourself, of dancing, of singing. Dogs and cats live from their tails. I mean, you know, they're way even beyond the bottom of their spine. Their whole energy is, you know, beneath their spine. There's nothing wrong with that for cats and dogs, but once we reach the human level, we have the capacity to transcend
the hold that matter has on us, and that's when we begin to try to live higher and higher up the chakras. Otherwise, we just keep reinforcing what we are now capable of transcending. Does that make sense? And that's why you get all these prohibitions against things that people protest are a lot of fun. because it reinforces the wrong chakras, and that's not really what you're trying to do at this point. Does that make sense? So we just keep working on it. Once you get to the human level, even though your nervous system is capable of divine perception, you also have the free will to ignore it. So once you get to the human level, which takes quite a while, you can just wander around for a really, really, really long time. The river seeks the ocean, and inevitably you will find the ocean, but you can meander through the hills for pretty much as long as you want to. Just defining your happiness according to whatever you want to define it by until it no longer makes you happy. I mean, people do things even now, I'm sure you know it too. Before we bought this temple, we had a storefront that was over on California Avenue, and for a while this building that's now a restaurant was some kind of a nightclub. And we used to have these marvelous experiences up on the second floor of this building. We'd come down at 10 or 11 at night after our events were over, come onto the sidewalk, and the nightclub would just be getting underway. And the boom, 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 boom was so strong from there that you'd feel it under the street. You'd actually feel it on the sidewalk. And then there were swarms of people all at that time. Everyone wore black. Everyone was dressed in black. I remember once I got on my bicycle and I rode around behind there, and it was filled with all these people in black swarming into the boom, 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 boom like that. And I really thought I was in hell. I thought if you had put me into that nightclub, I probably would have just gone insane. And all the people were rushing to get in because they thought it was going to be so much fun. And it was just going to, I knew it was just going to be screaming noise and pounding rhythm and flashing lights, which was just, for me, the last thing in the universe I wanted to go into. And all those people were just pushing and paying and excited to get in. It's just a question of, where you live and what you define as pleasure, what you identify with. I've been there, I've done that, I'm not that old. But I never enjoyed it all that much. I didn't identify with that aspect of reality anymore. So I didn't want to be there. It wasn't my reality anymore. But you find it. You find it from experience. Religions then make rules, which thinking people then reject. Because we only learn from experience. And then that's why we reincarnate so many times. We only learn from experience. But this makes me laugh, and it's a silly example, but David and I have traveled a lot over the years, and I have a tendency when I used to put the suitcase on the hood of the car sometimes when I was doing something, and David would always say to me, "Don't put it there, it'll scratch the hood of the car." And I would always think, I just would, this is a suitcase. What do you mean I'll scratch it in the car? So then I was on my own, but I had his car. I was up at Ananda Village, and I put my suitcase on the hood of the car, and then I pulled it off, and I put this big scratch into the hood of his car. And I looked at it, and I thought, wow, he's been telling me this for 25 years. And I never believed him. It was such a stupid thing, but I never believed him. And there I'd scratched his car. He takes such good care of his stuff. I had his friend, my friend, call him before I came home to tell him that I'd scratched his car. Because I knew if he told him, it wouldn't be as bad as if I came home and just said. But it was so how many times has he told me the suitcase would scratch the car, and I never believed him. And it was just such a vivid, ridiculous example of the fact that we don't believe other people until we experience it. So it doesn't really make any difference what rules the church makes. You don't believe it until you experience it. And you don't experience it until you live through it. And you live through it, and then you know. And then it ceases to be real for you, the happiness-producing potential of this. But while you're in it, it's perfectly real. And you can't say to a teenager, "This is not any fun." He knows perfectly well it's fun. One of my friends, he said he had a very clever mommy. When this man, who was a grown man by then, was 12, he was a very sexually oriented man. And when he was 12, he started looking at Playboy magazine, which he hid under his mattress. And his mother found it. And his mother said to him, because, as he said, he had a very good mom, she said, his name was Paul, "Oh, Paul, I was at least hoping we could wait till you were a little older."
And then Paul says to his mom, show me something more fun, you know? He was perfectly open to it, but show me something more fun than this. And, you know, it was fun for his whole life. You know, that was just his attitude toward life, and he stayed there. In other ways, he was actually, just to be fair to him, he came down with cancer quite suddenly and died within 2 weeks. Died with absolute courage and detachment. Despite that orientation, when it was over, the party was over, and I've rarely seen anybody accept death so just gracefully and bravely. Well, it's been a good run, and now it's over. Goodbye, everyone. So what can you say? Okay, does that answer that?
I'm with you.
And we reincarnate over and over because we still think that living at the spiritual eye is boring compared to whatever. Make your long list. So we need a physical body again to work it out. We need to have children. We need to have sex. We need to have food. We need to smoke. We need to drink. We need to party. And just living at the spiritual eye without all that material experience is dull. By comparison, show me something more fun.
So we're in the infinite and we get bored, is what you're saying? In some
that
sense,
part of it
or
is...
Or we want to expand?
Well, how we ever got cast out from the infinite in the first place and got caught up as individuals is the unanswerable question. But once we get fully manifested into matter, we have to fight our way back. And it's a rotten trick, but even if you knew why, you're still stuck here. You would still have the same problem. So there's no really good answer to why.
To grow.
To grow. But since we are already infinite, why did we have to grow? I mean, I can argue the other side of it. I hate it when anybody does that to me, but...
No, it's great. Yeah. Well, infinite is growing, so it's a part of the infinite growing.
Yeah,
right?
We just have to do it.
That's my easy little thought. But yeah, sure.
It's the nature of joy to expand. It wants to expand into many different forms. Nonetheless, here we sit.
Right.
And no one, as Swami says, who ever realized God thought it was a bum deal. It's only those of us who are identified with a lesser reality who get annoyed with that. But this attitude toward life also makes you very accepting both of yourself and other people. And I'll bring it to education for life. You see, we look at the children and we think, well, you know, what are they deeply identified with? And both of you have mentioned aspects of your children's own nature. They're deeply identified with these qualities. But one of the reasons that we're able to work so effectively with the children is that we never really think that that's who the child is. Mm. It's a great difference between that's who he is and that's what he's identified with. And you realize if he's identified with it, he's identified with it because somewhere along the line he thought it was a good idea and he thought it would make him happy. So if you can begin to show him that he'll find greater happiness by identifying with another aspect of his own potential, and you were talking about your son, he just noticed that when he behaved differently, it was wonderful. And that would make you want to do that. You never give up, one of my friends put it this way, don't even try to give up a bad habit until you're absolutely disgusted with it. Gandhi put it another way, Mahatma Gandhi. He said, you can never give up a pleasure until you replace it with a higher pleasure. And when you enjoy something more, and sometimes you enjoy the discipline of repudiating something even before you have the higher pleasure, but you know it's there. It's more than just an externally imposed idea. Some part of you wants to go there. You recognize that losing your temper all the time is not working for you. You recognize that self-abnegation is not working for you, that crippling insecurity is not working for you, that hating your enemies is not working for you. And then you begin to seek something else. And our understanding, based on this understanding of life, is that it's just a habit. And therefore it's all mutable. It's just a question of giving the children the opportunity to understand another reality, and even more importantly, to experience it. And then we teach them according to what we describe as the four stages of maturity, you know, the feeling years, the will years. Yeah, too much of education, way too much of education. It's just about the intellect. They don't recognize any of this. They're not even trying to educate this part of the person, but to speak of using the tools that will actually reach the person. And so we're always looking to see, you know, what have they identified with, what is the next stage they could be moved toward. And you can't just move, you know, well, I'll use a good example. Swami Kriyananda, who of course is the expressor of this whole system, and there was he wanted to take a portrait of this family. There were three children, two older daughters, and the youngest one was a son. And the son was about four at the time. And the four of the five members of the family were all there to have their portrait taken. The girls are all dressed up. The little boy's under the bed and won't come out from under the bed. Just won't come out from under the bed. And no amount of coaxing or threats from his parents is getting him out from under the bed. Swami, who understood the child well, leaned over and he said, "I have a bar of Swiss chocolate I'll give you if you'll come out of bed, out from under the bed." The boy rushed out of bed. No, he didn't say Swiss chocolate. He said, "I'll give you a dollar if you'll come out and let me take your picture." The boy rushed out of bed, out from under the bed, posed perfectly for as long as he wanted, because he did not experience pleasure in being good, but he experienced a great deal of pleasure in getting things for himself, especially money. And from that point, his mother began to pay him to do the right thing. And then what happened is she consistently paid him to do the right thing, and then he began to discover that he enjoyed doing the right thing. But there was no way to get him to do it to be nice to the family, because Swami Kriyananda wants you to. Those were absolutely meaningless to him. He was at the stage, his specific gravity was self-centered. His specific interest was money, even though he was only 4 years old. So you give him what he wants, you get the right response from him, you give him the experience of having the right response, and then gradually he realized the experience itself was the pleasure. Of course, you have to be very astute to do it. But to motivate him by ideals was useless. He was completely uninterested in ideals, and he was smart enough to know that nobody was going to beat him. He could just stay under the bed. You know, the mother had noticed it, but she'd been embarrassed to pay him. When she saw Swami just pay him, she thought, well, if he can do it, I can do it. It was a very funny situation. The father was actually quite materialistic, so the son came by it honestly. Son's grown up to be an absolutely wonderful, noble soul, but at that point, that was where he was. And he had to be moved. Anyway, so all of that. Now, having said that, I want to teach you more about meditation today, can I? Okay, that took a long time, but let's go. I want to teach you some of the real, you know, last week I gave us a context. I want to just now talk to you about some of the real fundamental basics of meditation so you can work with this a little bit. I made reference to the chakras, which are the energy centers that flow through the center of the body, which I won't go into now because it would take us way too long. There's just a few principles of meditation that need to be understood. Meditation, the subtle energy flow that we're working with does flow through the center of the body, and the physical spine is essentially the defining place, even though the energy is actually non-physical and it flows in the center of the physical spine, so to speak. So meditation works best if we're sitting with a straight spine. Because when we bend our spines like this, it's not only that the energy flow itself is cramped, but the psychological attitudes that are related to bending the spine are not the same attitudes that we're trying to develop when we're trying to meditate. And if we think about it, you know, whenever we feel depressed about something, this is the posture that we assume, isn't it? Whenever we're afraid, we're like this. And we're not going to listen and not going to do what people want. We curl in upon ourselves like this. We don't have any hope. We look down. And the way the body is arranged profoundly affects the mind. And so it's hard to get at the mind. It's hard to get at the spirit. But one of the ways we can access it is what we do with our body. This is the entire principle of yoga postures in its true form, which is not merely to make us healthy, but also to give us to help harmonize and give us peace of mind. We place our body in certain positions, and that induces certain states of awareness. Ananda yoga combines every yoga posture with an affirmation that reinforces what the physical posture is saying. But in terms of meditation, this is part of the reality of it. Now, it's not so easy for us to sit in a straight posture if we're not accustomed to doing it. These chairs are not bad, but most chairs in the West are part of what one Swami called the international conspiracy against proper sitting and breathing, which is mostly they're tipped backwards so that your hips go lower, and of necessity you have to bend the bottom of your spine in order to sit comfortably.
bucket seats in cars are really terrible. We moved heaven and earth to find these chairs, which at least are flat. You may find it easier to sit more comfortable if you put a little wedge under your bottom. We don't have the capacity to do that here because we don't have any materials, but folding up a blanket or something. You find if you tip yourself slightly forward, you'll find you'll be able to sit a lot more comfortably. So if you're not able to sit comfortably, experiment with it a little. It's also generally easier to sit straight if you're not leaning back, but just perched on the edge. I'm not going to ask you to do any of those things unless it's really comfortable for you. Ideally in meditation, you're not leaning back against a chair, but it depends on what size your body is, how big your bottom is, how big your hips are, whether your spine is in adjustment or so on. So fundamentally in meditation, though, we want to sit up straight. The other aspect of meditation is we want to be receptive, and these are realities that I'll just talk about a little bit more. We still have several weeks to go. We're not, when you're meditating, you feel like you're creating this from inside yourself, but you're not. What you're actually doing is you're pulling back from this constant distraction, and you're actually perceiving and receiving vibrations of energy that are always trying to reach us, but we're always too busy to notice them. Have you ever tried to get your child's attention when he didn't want to hear you? You call his name over and over again. His ears work fine, but he's not interested in hearing you. There is this vibration, and literally also a sound of the own sound that is happening around us all the time, but we're so busy doing other things, we're not receiving. And when we're meditating, we're trying to receive a flow of energy that's always there to be received. And we use our bodies to put ourselves into a receptive position and state of mind. The spine being straight is receptive. We try also to either have the palms open and up, which is more receptive than this, even though down is sometimes comfortable, but having your palms turned up is more open. Or we do something with our hands that in some way seals the energy in instead of letting it be distracted. For many years, I meditated with my hands joined. These are called mudras. When you do something that has a power in the body, you see, if you do this, you close the circuits. So we either open the circuits to be receptive or we close the circuits completely. Then there's in-between things. You see statues of the Buddha often like this or like this. I find when I sit to meditate with my hands open like this, I don't think about it, but they close. Because this also closes. This represents the ego, and it closes that circuit. Now, you don't have to actually do any of these things, but you just sort of want to have some idea of what's a good idea, because, believe me, we need all the help we can get. Now, another aspect of meditation that's really helpful, and I talked about the subconscious, the conscious, and the superconscious, and my hands are at my eyes when I say that. The position of the eyes relates to those three levels of consciousness. Most of the time, when you're conscious, we're just looking pretty straightforward, right? As a public speaker, I've watched people fall asleep in front of me, which is an art that most people don't get to see, although you do get to see your children fall asleep. Invariably, when people fall asleep, their eyes drop. That's just what happens. You get sleepier and sleepier, and your eyes drop. Because dropped eyes are associated with the subconscious. And when you wake up, you might not realize it, but you not only open your eyelids, but you roll your eyes upward. Okay? Slightly raised eyes are associated with superconsciousness. So the three positions, straightforward, dropping down, and slightly raised. The first meditation exercise we did, I was telling you to look out a window that was a little bit in front of you. I was just, without explaining, just offering those things. When you're raising your eyes slightly, it has to do with the spiritual eye, which is the point between the eyes, but you're not looking at the spiritual eye. As Sri Yukteswar said, the spiritual path is hard enough without trying to do it cross-eyed. So you're not really crossing your eyes. But if you put your hand out in front of you, if you stretch your arm out like I'm doing, and put your thumb not at eye level, but just above, you know, there's a point at which your two eyes converge, and you can look upward in a very relaxed way, but you're sort of looking out from. So that's why I offered you the image at the first. You know, there's a window that's just a little higher than the level of your eyes, and in order to look out of it, you just look out. And what we're trying to do when we're meditating, and this is like something that you just kind of have to get your mind around, we always think that we're looking in. We're not looking in, we're expanding from. Because we're very identified with this small reality, we want to expand from it. But we're not expanding out in the physical sense, where this is the paradox of it. We're stopping all that outward movement and just freeing the inner reality to expand from. In actual fact, the ego identification is centered at the medulla, which is right here. And that's why people are centered in their eyes. It's not really because of vision, it's because the sense of self is centered at the medulla, that when the sperm and ovum come together, this is where they come together. This is the first point, and they can't operate on this point. They can't touch the medulla. If they touch the medulla, life is gone, like that. If the brain tumor is here, they can't operate on it. They can operate all around it. You might turn into a vegetable, but you'll still be living. If they touch it here, you're gone. So we are looking from here. This is the negative pole of the spiritual life. So we're actually looking from here, through here, out. And I offer that. I'm offering lots of different images. You don't have to use them all. But that's what we're doing. We're just relaxing, and we're actually, these two eyes are converging. And if you do a line, they're converging about here. Because we're drawing our consciousness from ego identification to identification with the infinite. So with closed eyes, we focus about where you would focus if you had your hand in front of you, except you're not really looking there. But without strain, you're just looking up, as if you were looking at a movie screen from a seat that's kind of close. So you're just very, in a very relaxed way, just looking up. Now, it's possible to visualize at that point. And that's a whole form of meditation, but I'm not really going to teach you exactly that right now. Mostly, that's just simply where we focus our gaze. So, we have the posture of the body, comfortably upright, and I should go downstairs, if not this week, next week, and show you devices you can use on the floor. You put your hands either into a comfortable mudra or just in an upright position, whatever works comfortably. You get your vision centered so that your eyes are slightly raised, but then you close your eyes. Okay? And so this is what we're doing with our physical body. You will find also, when your mind wanders in meditation, invariably you have lowered your eyes. And merely by raising your eyes up again, you will find that your consciousness will come back to a clearer focus. Because inevitably in meditation, your thoughts intrude. This all sounds so great, and I'm going to sit down and meditate, and you meditate about 30 seconds, and then you realize you're just making a shopping list. You know, you're doing something completely else. But if you look, you'll realize your eyes are either straight out or looking down. So let's just spend a minute, and don't worry too much about your thoughts. Let's just kind of sit comfortably, and then just try to keep your eyes upward. If it helps you to imagine that you're looking at something uplifting, last time I suggested a tall Himalayan mountain. If you see any kind of lights, try to just concentrate in the center of what you see. Everything you see is a distorted aspect of the spiritual eye before it comes into clear focus. So you just want to look toward the center of whatever you might see. No, this is just a building block. We need to add a little bit more before we can settle comfortably. The next element that we need, we have posture, we have focus of the eyes, we have the idea of energy being focused at the spiritual eye, drawing it from the medulla to here. You don't have to worry about the medulla, I'm just explaining that. You just are looking out. The spiritual eye, you'll see it, is like right there. When you see it, it's just in front of you. But there's no there at that point, so it doesn't matter. But it feels like it's bigger than you and you are going into it. But the other element that's absolutely essential to good meditation is the breath. And almost every meditation technique that you learn sooner or later starts talking to you about your breath. There's subtle metaphysical reasons for this, and there's also simple practical reasons. The force of life within us is the subtle energy that flows up and down the spine. That energy emanates from the medulla, and because of that up and down flow of the energy, our breath goes in and out. And it's because of the presence of that, of the jiva, which is the subtle force of consciousness that we are, we breathe. And when the soul withdraws, when we die, in other words, when the jiva goes away, there, nothing can make the body breathe. They can pump it in and out, but it ceases to have its life. When yogis go into deep states of meditation, they also go breathless, which is that the energy goes back, the consciousness goes all the way back into that energy flow, and there's no need for the breath of the body to continue breathing, but that's a much higher state. But in between, our state of consciousness is always reflected in the breath. If you see a crummy actor on the stage trying to tell you how afraid they are, they will always do it by agitating the breath. And if you ever see that you're really frightened about something, you'll realize that your breath is reflecting that. When I first began to understand that, I realized that when I became emotionally upset, which I was more inclined to do when I was younger, if I just breathed, if I controlled my breath and just breathed in and out in an even, measured way, it's impossible to cry and breathe evenly and deeply at the same time. Of course, when I wanted to cry, I didn't want to breathe evenly and deeply. So I could stop it, but then I would stop doing the breathing because I preferred to cry. But you can, in other words, you can change your state of consciousness by your breath. Especially if you calm the breath, it will automatically calm the mind. That's why we teach the children, when they're upset, to breathe. Watch your breath, begin to breathe. You'll see when your children are crying, if you can get them to breathe in and out deeply, they can't simultaneously cry because there's this intimate relationship between your state of mind and your breath. And you will notice too that if you're really concentrating on something, you will automatically bring your energy to a focus at this point, and you will often hold your breath. If not for a long time, at least for a minute. If you say, I just really want to remember, let me see if I can remember. And you'll stop breathing. You'll just hold your breath while you really try to concentrate, because intuitively we know that we can concentrate deeper if we're not distracted by the breath. The breath is also in between voluntary and involuntary. We can influence the breath, and we will in just a moment. We can do regular, measured breathing. You know, we can breathe in for a certain count, we can hold the breath, we can exhale at the same count. We can, by our willpower, decide how we're going to breathe. At the same time, you can't commit suicide by holding your breath, because you'll hold your breath to the point where you're oxygen deprived, your brain is oxygen deprived, you will go unconscious, and then you'll start breathing. Because it's between controllable and uncontrollable. Because the breath is also the link to the fact that we're incarnated and alive altogether. The baby is born, and even if the body is perfect, everybody waits till that first breath is taken, because if the child doesn't take that first breath, there's no life there. Yogananda says the reason the baby cries at that point, because it realizes it's incarnated again. And it cries because here it is. It's come out of the astral world, it's in a physical body, and the whole thing is starting over. And he says that's why the baby cries. And if you've ever sat with someone when they're dying, I was with my father, I've been with a few other people, in the end, if the person doesn't die suddenly, it's all about the breath. And you're just sitting there, and you're just listening to the breath, and you're listening to the person breathe. And if you have done it a few times, you realize it's very, very interesting. In the last hours or minutes of a person's life, it's a struggle to breathe in. You'll hear them go, like this, and then a little time will pass, like this. And then at a certain point, the struggle is to breathe out. And if you're ever doing a death vigil with someone, As soon as they begin to struggle to breathe out, you have to bring everybody to the bedside because it's almost over. The person will start go, like that. Because the last breath is an exhalation. The first breath is an inhalation. The last breath is an exhalation. The air is cast out. The soul departs. And that's the end of it. And they'll just take a little in. They'll push a lot out. They'll take a little in. They'll push more out. And then finally the last breath. And there's, they call it the death rattle. You hear it. And then they just breathe out. And then they don't. Then the breath, you wait. The breath doesn't come in again. Then you know they're gone. Sometimes there'll be a sort of a long pause. My father just freaked us all out because he breathed out, he stopped breathing. My sister and brother and I said, well, that's it. And we were just sort of settling in, and then he went, one more time. And sort of, you know, with this kind of panicky feeling, like I felt like he was outside his body, and then he got really nervous and he wanted to get back in. So he took one more breath. Then when he let that one out, he went away. And there was, truthfully, a tremendous sense of joy. Very great joy. He was, I'm sure, reunited with my mother and was just very happy. But that was, he scared us. He just scared the bejesus out of us. He really did when he took that last extra breath. But it's all about the breath. So we can use that to our advantage when we meditate. And we use that in several different ways. We prepare for meditation by doing measured breathing. Because when you start controlling the breath, you're also controlling the mind. You're also controlling the feelings, the heart and the mind both. I need to bring both of them into this. When you're breathing in a measured way, the feelings of the heart are calm, and when the feelings of the heart are calmed, the mind automatically follows. We think that the agitation in meditation comes from your mind, but your mind is agitated because your heart is agitated. When your heart is perfectly, I mean, what do you think? Your feelings get agitated and then you get upset, isn't that right? And when your feelings are calm, then your mind just follows along naturally. Reason follows feeling. So we use breath in two ways. One is we use it to calm ourselves down, both our heart and our mind. We calm ourselves down by calming the breath. That's the conscious part of it. Then the other part of it is we use the breath as an ever-present point of focus that we can concentrate on, and that gives us a portable device because we always have it with us. I was doing a radio interview about stress reduction exercises, and the man says, I'm way too busy to do stress reduction, you know? I said, well, do you breathe? You know, like if you breathe, you can practice stress reduction. So of course I breathe, everybody breathe. But if we start becoming conscious of our breath and we use the breath, the observation of the breath becomes the point of focus for meditation, because what it does is it brings our attention in from all external realities, because everything else is external to the breath. Because the breath is the fundamental force of life that holds us to our bodies. Everything else is external to the breath. So if we can bring our attention back to the breath, we have brought our attention to the center life force from which everything else emanates. And by just observing that, that very act causes us, at least for the moment, not to identify with anything except the jiva itself. Okay, and then as we concentrate on it, that actually also automatically, it's calming to concentrate on the breath, because it's also separated us from everything else that agitates us. And that's why people always say, don't get upset, just breathe, just breathe. A yogi I heard once gave a marvelous lecture saying basically, actually, the only thing you have to do your entire life is breathe. If you're always consciously breathing, of course that was the key, then you'll always be exactly where you need to be, mentally, emotionally, physically, everything. Because if you're aware of that, you're aware of the source of your physical life, your physical and your spiritual life. It links you. The breath is a symbol of a deeper reality, and the key to a deeper reality, it's also the doorway into this world. So you can just stand right on the cusp and be master of both realities. Okay? The other thing about the breath is, and this breathing in this kind of meditation is done through the nose. You always see also that people, mouth breathing is the way actors also show that someone is kind of stupid. You know, this, you know, and it's even an insult. I've heard it as a slang insult, is to call someone a mouth breather, which in yoga is also a very bad thing.
So in this exercise is always done breathing through the nose, because also, you see, when the air comes in through the nostrils, where does it go? It goes right to the point between the eyebrows. It goes right to the spiritual eye. So when you're also, when you're watching the breath, you're actually bringing your attention up here to this chakra, to the spiritual eye, which is really what you want to do. So ultimately what we do is first we use the breath by controlling it to calm ourselves down, and then we just observe the flow of the breath. And the primary exercise, and it sounds simple but it's really big, is to sit still in the proper posture and simply observe the breath flowing in and observe the breath flowing out, as much as possible through the nostrils, and gradually you become conscious of breathing at the spiritual eye. But you can be conscious of it wherever you need to be conscious of it, at the diaphragm, at the lungs, because we are practicing our power of experiencing what is always there. And now that goes deeper. We begin to experience states of consciousness, states of awareness, feelings, aspirations that are also always there. But we begin with the breath because it's physical and we can find it. Okay, so we have the right posture, we have the right point of concentration, we have the object of concentration, which is now the breath. There's one more piece to this, which is that you'll find that you can sit there and watch the breath and your mind can just, you know, run circles around the fact that you're watching the breath. So we have to do something with the monkey mind. We have to give it something to chew on. So we give it a mantra. A mantra is a sound that has power. And that the mantra that goes with the breath is actually two Sanskrit syllables that have deep meaning. And those, that particular mantra works really well with the breath, because on a very subtle level, it is the actual astral sound of the breath. Plus, the meaning of the mantra is exactly the meaning that we want to affirm. Now, for people who are following Yogananda's path and are going to progress through the many steps of Yogananda's path into more and more subtle forms of meditation, it's very helpful and important to use that mantra. If your interest is less specific and you're sort of just picking up things here and there, you can modify the mantra to something else that you want. But I'm going to teach you the mantra and then you can make your decision about it later. The mantra is what's called a Bij mantra, which means that it's a condensed sound. And it's two words, and it's, the first one is hong, but it's sort of, you don't say this out loud, but you just say it in your mind, hong, and the NG sound is part of it. But don't worry too much, you know, just don't say hong. It's hong, it's more like the breath. And the second word is saw, like that, it's pronounced, you know, saw. Hong. Hong is the inhalation, and this is only mental, you don't say this out loud. Hong, and then sa is the exhalation. And when you're observing the breath, you're not doing it in any particular speed. The breath flows in. Hong as the breath flows in, sa as the breath flows out. Interestingly, there's something we call the Hong snore technique, because when people snore, they go, right? It's the subconscious variation on this, because it's the actual sound of the breath. And what it means is, I am infinite. Sometimes we can just use the male pronoun, I am he. I am one. I, the little ego, am one with the infinite self. The breath itself says, I am infinite. Now, there's power in the mantra, which is why we just don't use whatever colloquial language there is. You can say, I am infinite, if you prefer.
Do the children use the mantra?
No, I don't think so. I bet the older children do. I bet Gary teaches them the mantra, but I don't know if they teach it younger.
I think Gary teaches them also.
Yeah, I suspect Gary does. I don't know if Matthew does or not. Oh, yeah. When I taught meditation to a group of juvenile delinquents, the friend of mine brought he worked with kids in lieu of prison, literally. He brought a crowd of them over. And I just didn't really think Hong Sa would go over very big with these guys. And so I was asking them, I taught them a great deal of what I taught you, but then when it came to the mantra, I was asking them to sort of
I wanted them to do something that lifted their energy. I said, so we need a mantra that, you know, that, that makes you feel uplifted. So one of the boys said, girls, sex, girls, sex, like that. And I said, you know, I started thinking really fast. And I said, well, you know, that's just great. But what if you, there's no girls and you have no sex? And every time you say it, you just feel deprived. You don't really feel fulfilled. And I, oh, that's a problem, isn't it? Because he was immediately moving out from the breath to all the things he was identified with. So I said, we have to have something that nothing can take away from you that's just your choice. So I taught them to say, I am peace. And you know, they came and went, and I thought, well, that was a fun exercise. I got two letters. I mean, you know, they were like wonderfully fulfilling but deeply heartbreaking. Last night when my dad got drunk and started beating my mother, I just went into my room and I practiced what you taught me. And he said, and for the first time, he said, I was able to just not, you know, become hysterical when that happened. The other one I don't quite recall, but it was something very, very similar. Just being, I think it was being bullied on the bus. And he just sat on the bus and just stared out the window and just went into his breath and started doing it. And he thanked me so much for, you know, giving him some place to go. But the thing is, you see, if you really go into the breath, you're not going nowhere. This is the difference between subconscious and superconscious. If you really go into the breath with an affirmation that takes you up, and remember what I said about the point of the why? When you get to that, when you've rolled back your experience of everything external that you identify with, most of the time at that point we lower our energy even more and we go to sleep. And that falls us into subconscious. If we have withdrawn from everything that we identify with, but take all that energy that we're normally using in that way, but use it all to hold ourselves perfectly still, to say two syllables, Om, Saw, and to just live in the breath, then we go into superconsciousness. And when we get into super consciousness, the higher has mastery over the lower. This is why, as strange as it seems, even a little bit of meditation will completely change your life. Even if you think your meditation is terrible. Because the effort to bring yourself to that point just begins to create an entirely new reality for you. You just begin to peek at this higher level of reality from which everything else is controlled. And you activate a relationship with your superconscious that is always trying to get through to you, that begins to break through. And it breaks through not just when you're meditating, but you've opened a door to it all the time. And you begin to have intuitions. You begin to have moments of extraordinary calmness. You begin to be suddenly non-reactive. And you don't even know where it's coming from. But it's come from the fact that you've begun to identify with something more fundamental than all of the things that have always just cast us about. You begin to have an anchor point. Just exactly that. Okay, does that make sense? Now, the other thing that really helps this is to do it with feeling. I mean, it seems like Hong saw the breath, and it doesn't seem really very interesting. But what we're really doing is we're lifting everything we are up into the light. And if you have a devotional nature and can feel a sense of God's presence, if you have a devotion to a particular image of the divine, whether it's Mother Mary or Jesus or Krishna, or if just the image of light is what attracts you the most, but try to have some sense that you're aspiring to something. This is where visualization can help you. I'm reaching for the top of the mountain. I'm going into the sun. I'm expanding out into the ocean. But something that gives it feeling quality to it, because otherwise it's pretty dull. And we're doing our we're using our creative imagination to reach for that quality, but the fact of the matter is that quality is actually there. And this is what we were talking about. The superconscious exists, and we all have touched it at one point or another. You know that what happens to us. And I talked about my father dying, death and birth are certainly moments when all of a sudden just something cracks and you know you're part of something that you didn't know you were part of. And that's what we call back to mind when we meditate, and the imprint on our consciousness of deliberate meditation, that's what I was saying a moment ago, is much deeper than you realize. Okay? So, any questions? If not, then we'll go into a prayer. Now, the feeling quality is the reason that we pray, and it's the reason that we always chant a little bit. We often chant a little bit before we meditate. We pray because we want to put ourselves into a connection with the higher reality. So I'm going to sort of run us through a little bit of an exercise here. And what we'll do is we'll pray, we'll chant, we'll do a little bit of measured breathing, which is just as simple as just inhaling in a comfortable way to a count of 6 or 8, whatever you can do easily, holding the breath for the same period of time, and I'll lead us in a very short count, exhaling to the same count, and then starting it over again. We'll just do that a few times, just to help us to find our breath. And then we'll exhale, and then when the breath comes back naturally, we'll start the Hong Sa practice, okay? So let's begin with a prayer. And what we're describing, as I said at the beginning, we're describing aspects of the divine, the feminine, the masculine, the friend, the teacher. And I won't enumerate all the gurus this time, we'll go quicker. So please respond with me, but feel that you're saying this, you're addressing the light in front of you as you say this. Heavenly Father.
Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Friend, beloved God.
Friend, beloved God.
Great gurus.
Great gurus.
Divine light within me.
Divine light within me.
We bow to all of you.
We bow to all of you.
Help us in our meditation.
Help us in our meditation.
To feel your presence.
To feel your presence.
Awaken our hearts.
Awaken our hearts.
Calm our minds.
Calm our minds.
Concentrate our attention.
Concentrate our attention.
That in our own breath, we may find the doorway to infinity.
We may find the doorway to infinity.
Om peace. Amen. Let's now just find the breath first deliberately, just by relaxing in as much as you can from the diaphragm. Just inhale, I'll count to 6. Just inhale in a very relaxed way. 1, 2. Now hold your breath. Now exhale. Do it again a little more slowly. Hold the breath. Exhale. One more time. Just breathe in deeply. the breath out. One more time. Let the breath out. And once again. And then exhale, and the next inhalation, chant Hong mentally as the breath comes in. And then when the breath goes out, chant Saw mentally. If you can't feel the breath flowing in and out of the nostrils, then you can put your hands on your diaphragm. Feel it breathing in and out there. Now we are sitting in a comfortable upright position. Our hands are in a receptive, palms upward, or fingers laced mudra. We're breathing through the nose. Our eyes are looking slightly elevated. And then we watch the breath flow in. As it flows in, say Hong mentally. As it flows out, say Saw. Just follow it. If you find that you've lost the mantra, you have no idea where the breath is, all you have to do is breathe in, breathe out, and on the next inhalation, start it all over again. Doesn't matter how many times you lose the focus, just keep coming back. For a little less than 10 minutes. Do you think you can replicate that in your home? And try to do that. That's a meditation that you can use anytime, anywhere. You can meditate for as long as you're comfortable. Ideally, it's nice to meditate when you first wake up in the morning and you're coming out of subconscious, you're actually close to superconscious. So it's very good to meditate just before you go to sleep. And as soon as you can after you wake up in the morning, even for just a few minutes. But the best time to meditate is when you will. So ideally meditate in the morning, meditate at night. We can talk more about that. But any time that you can, if you're in the middle of your work and you can shut the door, if you have an important meeting and you need to calm yourself, if you have a conversation with, you don't know how to get to do it exactly right, just get yourself back to your breath. Get back to your breath. Pull yourself in from all that scatters you, and then when you come forward again, you find you have more mastery. Well, that's just the beginning, but that's a good step. Is there any questions, or does it work? Can you see the possibility? There's much more that could be said, but that's the basic. What do you think?
It was really very interesting. I had the image of someone, you know, learning how to ride a bike, who was teetering out of control, but headed in the right direction.
That's exactly,
you know?
Perfect. That just about sums it up.
That's what it felt like.
Yes, exactly right. You're teetering out of control, but you're going somewhere. The thing about meditation is, no matter how badly you do it, you will get benefit from it. It's like a miracle drug.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anything that you would want to add, Eric? I never gave you a moment to put a word in. Okay. Right, well, if you can, give it a try sometime between now and next week, and then tell me whether it worked or it didn't. And then we can build on this. But. Okay. Maybe when we start our class next week, we can go downstairs into the bookshop, and I will show you some benches and cushions if you like, but also there's some CDs and things that can also help you, or else I'll bring them upstairs. A few allowable cheats that make it easy. Including earplugs, which if you have children is a really good idea. Most of us meditate with earplugs because we don't live out in the forest. Okay. All right. That
will do us for tonight. Serve me, my dear.